The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm your host for the show, Robin Daly, the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's helping people with cancer across the UK to understand and access the benefits of integrative medicine. This week, I have a very distinguished guest to introduce, Professor Angus Dalgleish. He's Professor of Oncology at St George's University of London and Principal of the Institute for Cancer Vaccines and Immunotherapy. Professor Dalgleish has been involved in some fascinating areas of cancer research, and some of his discoveries hold vital keys to treatment success for anyone with cancer. I'm talking to Professor Dalgleish over the phone. Professor Dalgleish, welcome back to the Yes to Life show. And I checked, it's just about 3 years since I last interviewed you.
Really, that long?
Yeah, it is. Time flies. So I want to talk to you about a number of areas of cancer research you are and have been involved in, but I'd like to start out with immunotherapy. Up until recently, we were subjected to massive hype and cast iron uncertainties around targeted drugs. The end of cancer was in sight, it would all be wrapped up in a few years. But as the luster of those treatments has faded rather rapidly, immunotherapy has been rapidly wheeled out in its place as the next big thing. So is there genuine reason to suppose that it'll be more successful than its predecessors?
Well, it's certainly been a sea change and affected everybody's interpretation of what's involved in the treatment of cancer. It has gone from being quite honestly ridiculed 10 years ago to the granting of a license for these checkpoint inhibitors, the first of which was ipilimumab or Yervoy a few years ago. And what was impressive about that was that although it had a very small complete response rate, I mean, it was less than 1%, it made a difference to the five-year survival in melanoma patients and therefore was approved in spite of really significant toxicity.
Right. So you obviously feel this is an important move that's happened and that attention is being focused in a more useful area.
Yes, well, since the ipilimumab, which is basically got accepted because of the fact there was a tail in these patients with metastatic disease of melanoma, and that over 20% were surviving 5 years, as opposed to about half that with all the other previous therapies.
Right.
There's been a rapid improvement in the new drugs that we have to use, and the what I would call the brothers and sisters, which are aiming at similar but different things, and people will know them as pembrolizumab or Keytruda or nivolumab or Nevo. Now, these target slightly different ligand on the cells, and they are slightly more effective, and the toxicity profile, while still very significant, is slightly less than the first generation. So we refer to these really as the second generation antibodies. And these have actually improved the five-year survival, and they certainly have a better response rate. Mm. And the response rate can be, overall response rate can be 30 to 40%.
Right.
More recently, and we are talking about melanoma here, they have been combined, such as the ipilimumab and nivolumab, for instance, and the response rate goes up to between 40% and 50%, but at very, very significant toxicity.
Yes.
And it can be very, the toxicity can be very difficult to manage.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing, I think, for people with cancer is that, unlike a lot of early vaccine studies and cytokine studies, that this approach has already been shown to be effective in lung cancer, so much so that it has actually approved for first-line lung cancer now over chemotherapy.
Mm.
So this is a tremendous translation of all the work done on melanoma into, you know, a very, very common disease. And every time we go to a meeting with regards to immunotherapy, there is a new cancer type which has been reported as benefiting from immunotherapy. So I think it's fair to say now that the majority of cancer types are showing some response or having some benefit from immunotherapy. I would like to point out this is a far cry from when I tried to get grants to study immunotherapy for cancer from the Big Cancer Research Grant Authorities 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They told me that the concept of tumours being cured by immunotherapy was a phenomenon which only applied to mice and would never translate to humans. All I can say is how wrong they were.
Right, very much so. Well, you talked about the kind of timescales involved here, and lots of pharmaceutical companies may have been swift to jump on the immunotherapy bandwagon recently, but you, of course, have been in for the long haul. You've worked with this approach for how long?
Well, it started in the early 90s.
Right. So, and you've often really stood alone as the only serious high-profile advocate as well, I think, in Britain.
Well, I've had quite a few colleagues, but they've certainly been in the minority.
Yeah. So I think that there was a time when you had the government behind you to some extent, and Britain was looking like a bit of an international front runner in this field. Is that true?
I'm unaware of having the government behind.
Okay.
I must say that all my work has been really supported by the Cancer Vaccine Institute and the Institute of Cancer Vaccines and Immunotherapy, which is a coalition of patients and their families who realised that this was something that needed to be supported and could make a difference, and were aware that the big funding organisations were showing no interest at all. And that included the CRC at the time, MRC, etc. And so this was a tremendous underpinning and enabled us to get involved with a number of different trials and combinations which we would never have been able to have done.
Mm.
And the fact we were doing this attracted interest from companies who were developing things which had an immunological interest, and therefore they came to us. And I mean, the one which has been the biggest success, it's interesting, the ones you would have thought would have been the ones that make a big difference disappeared really. Whereas the one which was the most off-field, as it were, has been the most super successful, and that was the one that took the report that I had made widely available, that some patients with really serious autoimmune diseases could respond to thalidomide when they wouldn't respond to any other treatment, and that this was such a powerful effect that we ought to take this further. And I mean, that has been so gratifying to watch. It's been taken seriously and has ended up with the... I was always very keen that we took thalidomide and made analogues of it. That means like brothers and sisters and cousins.
Yes.
Because of the very bad side effects of thalidomide, which people immediately think of birth defects. But
they do.
As a physician, using it is a crippling neuropathy that taps the nerves and it just makes that you cannot use it long term.
Yeah.
Whereas these analogues, we were able to eventually, we screened hundreds if not thousands, but found a couple which were able to operate better than thalidomide in all the assays, but have less side effects. And the first of these was known as Revlimid, now known as lenalidomide, which is approved worldwide as first-line treatment for multiple myeloma. and now several lymphomas, and it's one of the biggest selling drugs in the world. Well, no, nobody would take that seriously when first looked at it, and it's been super successful. And I would say the same thing's going to happen with all the immunotherapy approaches. They were laughed at, first of all, and the side effect profile was a major, major issue, but once again, the newer ones have shown to work better with less side effects, and I think that's the way, what way we're going to go in future development.
Right, so it does sound very hopeful. You mentioned there the Institute for Cancer Vaccines and Immunotherapy. Would you tell us a bit more about that organisation, when it was set up, directly what its aims are, and who supports it? Because it's obviously supported a lot of fantastic and probably quite costly work.
It has been absolutely fantastic. It spun out of the fact years ago, shortly after I arrived at St George's, I was very keen on pursuing this approach and was not very keen to change my direction on the grounds that people would fund things they wanted me to do. So I really held out and said I wanted to do this immunotherapy. And initially we needed a laboratory that we could cope with cellular therapy, because I saw the vision that we could go in and treat cancer with expanding cells, etc. And St George's, give them their due, their charity, basically picked my proposal out of many, many, and supported it for a year. They only give 1 year support, and then they spread it quite rightly, and so everybody gets a chance of support. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we were doing a couple of major vaccines, one of which I was importing purely as an academic collaboration from America, Donald Morton from the John Wayne Cancer Institute, and we were clearly seeing a major benefit with this, and nobody else was particularly interested, and we needed money to do trials, to expand and go into other vaccines that people didn't have the money to do the early studies for. And so when the St. George's grant stopped, The lady who was doing the major fundraising found this such an important area that she said, I'm very keen to help to continue this, but it would have to be outside St. George's. And at this time, it was there was a lot of pressure to be able to bring this American vaccine full-time to the UK, so patients didn't have to go to America.
Right.
And these patients got together and formed the Cancer Vaccine Institute, and there were several of them, and did major fundraising and supported this, so I was able to build a small team to do these clinical trials and some basic research in that in the laboratory.
So it's a patient-led initiative. Brilliant. Well, so many things are. That has to be the way it is, unfortunately. But
I would like to point out that I think it is absolutely amazing that the patients had could see what was happening and the way to go, and ended up with their connections, etc., and doing the hard work of doing the fundraising and supporting it all themselves. One with a very significant donation that basically gave us the core for about 20 years
wow.
in order to build on that.
Yeah.
And this is something which has not been that common in my experience in the UK compared to the US.
Right.
Now, in the US, and recently a visit to Australia was the same, is that virtually everything there is funded by very rich philanthropists. And the names of the institutes or funds are attached accordingly. But it is a really large difference. Everything in America seems to have been, all the buildings, all the research labs, all the core support seems to have been initially set up by a grateful patient's family.
Mm. So maybe this is an important aspect that where it's a weakness in Britain that we don't have so much of this kind of resource to push an agenda that's different to the agenda of business.
Yes, I mean, there are a number of very good donors and philanthropists, etc. I think of, like, the Wilson Foundation has supported mm-hmm. structural research as opposed to the day-to-day in many areas in this hospital and throughout the whole of the UK medical community, and there are several others like that. Of course, the really big institutions. I mean, the Wellcome Trust is one such, but it came out of the benevolence of the founder of the Wellcome Pharmaceutical Company, which was eventually founded the Institute and put a lot of money in, and they fund medical research on their investments, and they are major. But those are just a few examples, where in the US there just seems to be myriad of such foundations that support all this sort of research.
Mm. Okay, all very interesting. Thank you. So, immunotherapy is a concept, the idea that the immune system is actually a great way to deal with the enormously complex problem of cancer, is flavour of the year now. Of course, it's far from a new idea, and sort of renegade alternative practitioners have been trying to achieve this kind of thing for decades. From everything that you know about immunotherapy, is the work that's being done now sort of natural extension of that, or is it some kind of parallel effort?
I think it's both. It's an extension and a parallel movement. The people interested in immunotherapy, like for decades, they were interested in stimulating the immune system directly. There was a lot of work with the BCG, the TB vaccine.
Yes.
It's an attenuated bug, which means it's still alive. And it stimulated the immune system very well and caused an immune response, which in a very few cases, some cancers responded to that alone. And it became the carrier, as it were, for a lot of vaccines. So they added in cells from tumours to it and other antigens, etc. This evolved slowly until they then discovered, and this started to come out of the basic research, drugs which were widely used in immunotherapy of cancers, such as interferon and then interleukin-2. The interferon was not nearly as effective as everybody had hoped, and the interleukin-2 was really researched in high doses that was very toxic and required very specialist facilities. So although it got approved in the States, it was never really took off here in the UK. And as one of the, I believe, only two people that used the high dose very early on, it was the side effects requiring a lot of intensive medical care that really prevented it being taken further. And today, I believe it's only used now in Manchester, where they have a large cell therapy unit and still use the high dose interleukin-2. So basically, everybody else has been looking at how can you improve this development with the vaccination stimulating the immune system and these cytokines. And then there's been many, many trials in all sorts of cancers with all sorts of vaccines. And to be quite honest, they haven't been that effective. And
right.
Part of our work was very much to look at they're clearly very effective in some people. You see some people who have got several patients who have complete responses to this. But unfortunately, the majority haven't had the benefit. And I would hasten to point out, this is still very much the case with the great breakthrough in immunotherapy that we have today.
Right.
And that is with whether you get Nivo, Pembro, whatever, the majority are not going to benefit. It's still the minority, but it's a much bigger minority than it used to be.
Okay.
So I'm taking on what we were doing before, and that was asking questions. What is the difference between people who respond really well to these treatments and those that don't? Well, we're starting to get on top of that. And it's only this week I signed off some proofs on the paper, which I'm very proud of, where we took all the patients who were on this vaccine several years ago, and where we had some complete responses, fantastic survival, but the majority of people progressed. And we asked what the difference was. And initially, we looked for all sorts of fancy changes in the blood, but there weren't any, so we gave that up, as it were, until somebody comes along with a brand new technology and they say they can identify all these proteins in the blood, even if there's only minuscule quantities of them. Do we have any samples they could test this out on any trial where we could see people who did well versus the people who didn't.
Okay.
So we did that, and to our great surprise, I was looking, like everyone else, for the golden marker. And they say, you have this marker, you will respond.
Yes.
We didn't get that. What we got was a lot of markers that were only present in high quantities in the people who didn't respond. And when we looked at these and analysed, these were all inflammatory markers. So it meant that the patients had a chronic inflammatory background.
Okay.
Well, all our other research had shown that chronic activation, chronic inflammation, switches off the immune response to cancer. So we had a lovely story here that you have patients who don't respond to this therapy have this set chronic inflammatory background switching their immune system off.
Right.
Well, we've said it's going to come out very, very shortly, and when I presented it at a meeting, a very much larger operation in the United States became very interested in it, and they said this is an interesting concept. And the next time I met up with the fellows doing this, they said that they had confirmed it, that it was the same thing for these brand new drugs. So ours was a vaccine, mm-hmm. and they said that the people who don't respond to these checkpoints and things like that have high inflammatory background markers too. So, to me, this is fantastic. We would never, ever have been able to have done this. Nobody would have funded this because the hostility of the referees that there should be a simple explanation along these lines was intense. It was turned down by all the major journals. And, we finally got it into a specialist journal, which is of very high impact. So, I'm actually quite delighted. But what does this mean? There's no point doing research just to satisfy your intuition or curiosity. What it means is you either exclude these people, because it really is black and white, they're not going to respond, you exclude them, but then that's the majority, that's not the point. Or, what I basically said, if they've got high inflammatory markers, why don't we pre-treat them with anti-inflammatories and damp down the inflammation and then treat them?
Yeah.
So that's the obvious way. That is really what's come out of this.
Mm.
And I really emphasise again, we could not have done that work if it hadn't been for the core backing of the Institute of Cancer Vaccines and Immunotherapy, because it's something that nobody thought was worthwhile doing, and even when we had the good results, they were all far too keen to pick holes in it on the grounds that it couldn't be true. It's far too simple and easy an explanation there. Be true.
Yeah, well, it's egos bouncing around. Unfortunately, it's like if we haven't found it so far, it must be complicated. It's tragic, that kind of resistance to finding out what the problem is, isn't it?
I must point out, it is a universal problem in science that when you come up with something different or a parallel way of looking at something, it immediately incites a hostility. And no more so than you come up with something that's really quite simple
right.
and sort of unlocks a complex system. I mean, I had it when, in very early days, my work showed that, with my team that I was working with actually in London here, that the HIV virus got into the cells using the CD4 molecule. Well, my boss, Robin Weiss, and others were so excited by this that we did all the things to show that there was no other explanation, lots of great science. And it was submitted to Nature, and it initially got turned down because the referee said, this seems far too simple an explanation, I don't believe it. It was only when it was really pushed, this is actually very good science, and you do science to find out what the reality is, not
yes.
what your speculation or concept is. And so I have seen it before, and of course, but I think the greatest example of this was Frank Whittle, who invented the jet engine. I need to be told by the presidents of the Royal Society, Royal Aeronautical Society, that he was completely deluded, because it was obvious to anybody that this engine would require more fuel to power it than it could possibly lift off the ground. Well, the rest is history.
All right. Well, that is, as you say, ever the story, and it is a tragedy, and it is the reason why we have to have private efforts, if you like, to drive forward change, because the establishment all too often sort of hunkers down and says, no, couldn't be true, can't do that, and isn't actually interested in the science, which is, it's tragic. I'm really interested in the whole thing you're saying about the inflammatory markers. And of course, yeah, inflammation isn't something that we can't deal with. You know, people can be pre-treated for that, obviously. And I was speaking to Professor Baum, the breast surgeon, a little while back, who was interested in surgery and inflammation, and actually the fact that he was beginning to realise from statistics he was getting that actually quite a bit of the problem was being caused with cancer patients after surgery was the result of the surgery itself, and that he could actually do something about that by administering an anti-inflammatory at the time of surgery.
Yes, that's very exciting, and I've heard about that. That is a really, really important thing, because it is the inflammation caused by the surgery which is, in a way, needed because of the requirement for wound healing.
Yes.
Wound healing and inflammation are very similar. But we have known for years that certain types of surgery will actually increase the chances of getting metastatic disease. And there's been this big suspicion that the surgery and the wound healing itself helps promote it. And we've certainly seen that a lot with certain skin cancers, when they, especially if they don't heal quickly, and the wounds don't heal, that you're more likely to get another one or spread. So that's a terribly important observation and fits in very much with our observations.
Yeah.
And makes us really do need to look at the importance of a good anti-inflammatory package, surgery, and I would say before we have our other immunotherapy treatments into patients, because there are some very good anti-inflammatories out there, and it's been known from experiments, from one of the experiment regimens we did in our laboratory, which showed that we could greatly enhance the effect of cancer vaccines in the laboratory by priming with lenalidomide, which is, you know, the Revlimid that I first spoke about,
yes,
developed from thalidomide. And we found that this was because, we thought it might be because it stimulated the dendritic cells to make the antigens present better. But actually, it's a very powerful anti-inflammatory.
Right.
Really powerful. So we think that is probably the most likely explanation, actually. It's the anti-inflammatory aspect of it. And it has already been used in a small randomized trial where it's been confirmed in human studies that the patients who got a few days on the lenalidomide had a better response to the vaccine than those who didn't. So I think we are on the verge of being able to greatly improve these immunotherapies.
Mm. But interestingly enough, that insight may improve all the therapies that currently exist.
Well, indeed, because some of the things that we've picked up, and we're talking about anti-inflammatories, and here I would say in my book, you know, vitamin D, which I've been proselytizing for a long time,
yes,
on the grounds that if you've got low vitamin D, you don't respond to a lot of things. Well, if you have high vitamin D, I mean, high in the normal sense, not therapeutic levels, you will actually respond to things much better than if you've got a low vitamin D. And once again, we know that the vitamin D is both anti-inflammatory and boosts the immune response to things. So we have a lot of evidence on that, and I was amazed, having presented one of our vaccine studies where we had very good results, and I said I think that the reason for this is that we are the only people ever to address vitamin D deficiency and made sure everybody with low vitamin D was supplemented. And we presented this, one of the top trialists in the United States said this is a very fascinating concept. I'm going to have a quick look at our work. Now he came back and he's only using chemotherapy. He never used immunotherapy in his entire life. And he came back to me, he said, you know, I cannot believe this. He said, the people who respond to the chemotherapies in our trial, the only ones with good responses are the only ones with normal vitamin D. The ones who don't respond, have poor responses, have low vitamin D. So this is the advantage of storing all the serum and everything from the trials. He was able to go back and look at it and say it is a very, very important thing. But I've been crying about this in the wilderness there for about 10 years.
Yes.
If you've got low vitamin D, you might as well give up. You know, you're not going to get a good response to to any kind of immunotherapy. Well, here, he shows me, and he was cynical about it, but he says it's just as appropriate for chemotherapy too. And yet, do people check the vitamin D levels in the NHS, with a few exceptions of the melanoma clinics, where it's been in, on the advisory protocols for some years now? I don't believe this, because everybody I see for a second opinion, none of them had their vitamin D checked.
Well, I'm glad to hear this going out on the radio, because, of course, a lot of the people who are listening are having treatment of one kind or another, and actually this is something they can take into their own hands and get their own vitamin D test. So it's potentially a real key to successful treatment, whatever your treatment might be. And very nicely, as you say, ties in with your other research about anti-inflammatories as well. So it's kind of you're pulling together pieces of the jigsaw.
Yes, and it's very gratifying in this day and age when every drug that comes out, every drug that's approved in oncology, is you're looking at a minimum of £5,000 a month for the drug you have to take for a year, 2 years, etc.
Yeah.
And then the immunotherapies are working out about £100,000 a year. And that's before you actually have to consider the serious cost of treating the side effects, which could be in the tens of thousands. I mean, several of them end up in hospital, having to have their colitis, you know, with a terrible diarrhea dealt with directly as a result of the treatment. So it is absolutely wonderful in this this age where I like to be introduced to a single healthcare system in the world that can possibly afford the implications of this. I mean, it's going to bankrupt all Treasury departments.
Absolutely.
So what is wonderful is that we've come up, because of this core funding, with such simple things which are actually effective, have no toxicity, and are very cheap, and therefore going to be of no interest to the current drug development system. So it's good to be able to do something useful that is not expensive and not toxic.
Yeah, very much so. And of course, the people who are actually interested in therapies that are cheap and that work are the public. You know, healthcare systems may ignore them because they don't fit their model, but the public is interested, and hence the importance of getting the message out about such simple interventions as vitamin D to the wider public so they can take matters into their own hands.
Without a doubt. I mean, I think we are going to need the population now to take a greater interest in their own health,
yes,
and to do things which are going to prevent them progressing to, it's not just cancers, it's all forms of chronic disease, and particularly we've heard so much about diet and weight gain and diabetes, etc. Well, that alone, if that's not addressed, it could bankrupt the NHS, just looking after half the population over 50 requiring diabetic treatment. So you have to think all these things through, and to actually educate the public and how to reduce their chances of requiring the NHS, I think is just so, so important. Because you've heard the news today. I mean, I was very much screaming about the importance of training more and more medical students and nurses, etc., on the grounds that we were going to need more and more. And yet, I found that my own medical school, we had superb applicants, and they were turned away because we just didn't have enough places and there were other people more deserving, etc. Only to find that over half the doctors that we have to recruit come from outside the UK. And I was always saying that this is really an absurd situation when you have so many people who really want to do it. And I couldn't understand why they wouldn't address that. They've just recently said they'll increase the number of doctors, but I would say it's too little, too late. And I'm saying this against the background that you heard only in the last week that we now have 1,000 less TPs than we did at the last election, where every single party promised, I'll repeat that word, promised an extra 5,000 GPs. And I said, where are they going to come from when GPs are retiring in droves because the workload has just got too much? So now we have 5 million people who can't see a GP for at least 3 weeks. So this is not going to be corrected anytime soon. So I do believe it's really important for the public to realise they're going to have to look after their own health and eat well, exercise, have their vitamin D, etc., to reduce their chances of requiring the services of a GP and specialist treatment in the future.
Well, very good. Well, I'm completely with you on all of that. Okay, so I'd like to do a little sidestep now. A subject that's of major interest to both the public and researchers at the moment, and has also been the object of a change in the law, is cannabis. It's quite well established there are enormous benefits to be had in areas such as pain management and controlling the side effects of conventional treatment. But I know you've had some interest in this area, and I assume you've been more interested in its potential for actually controlling cancer, am I right? And if so, what have you found?
Yes, we're very interested in that, and we did actually manage to get a grant some years ago to look at the cannabis and its constituents and the effect on cancer, given that the first of the investigations led to Sativex, which had got approved for the treatment of multiple sclerosis.
Yes.
And there was a lot of reports that it may be quite good for cancer, and these are very much anecdotal. So we looked at really hard systems for this, you know, and laboratory models, etc. And we found, we did a lot of tests, and it found that there was no great anti-cancer activity immediately. But we noticed that it looked like it could enhance radiotherapy. And we published this, and even I was incredibly impressed that how well, by giving a cannabis mixture during radiotherapy, it basically leads to complete control of a brain tumour in the laboratory model, whereas any of the constituents alone would just reduce it for a while and then it would escape. Now, I thought this was just so amazing because I had spent some of my time, I thought of doing radiotherapy for a while,
right.
And so I did specialise in that, and I became aware that the holy grail of radiotherapy was finding a radiosensitizer, something to make it work better.
Yes.
And there several great drug types were discovered, but they all fell by the wayside because of toxicity issues. And never really got anywhere. So here we had it on our hands, the compounds from the cannabis, which could actually do this holy grail which people have been looking for 30, 40 years. And so that immediately says this must be applied to the clinic, and certainly a small study has been done, but not actually using it during the radiotherapy, but after, which suggests there is a very positive outlook from this. So the next thing that we did in saying, you know, what is the anti-cancer activity? Is there any? So we put into these cell lines we have in culture, and you have to keep them in very good conditions and make sure they have enough food, etc., and they will carry on growing very well. And they're very good to see if you add a drug in, do they start to die? So we added the cannabis drugs into these experiments, and found we could literally shovel the drug in, and the cells wouldn't die.
Right.
So this was not a classic anti-cancer drug by any means, and this is important. So we then started to look at what is the effect of combining this with different agents. And often we do these together and sequentially, when sequentially meaning you give drug A, take it out, then give drug B. And in one of these experiments, we found the drug A being the cannabinoid, we wash it out, but because we do the controls, we left the cells there, nice and healthy, lots of food, etc., to compare them with the other ones where we, after washing out the cannabis, we added drug B to see whether that would increase it. And to our amazement, the cell lines that we'd washed the cannabis out, so they'd been exposed to it,
yes,
they all started to die. It was incredible.
Right.
And we thought, surely it's some mistake, they got the thing mixed up.
Okay. Yeah.
Heated it, and it's absolutely absolutely true. So this suggests it is the withdrawal of the cannabis that has this anti-cancer effect.
So
we recommend that it probably is better off being given intermittently. And a colleague, Dr. Kenyon, who has a lot of case series, we call it, he doesn't do trials, but it's confirmed that when he uses CBD in cancer patients, and these are patients who've given up chemotherapy, etc., he's confirmed that he's getting better responses, and we've helped him publish this recently in anti-cancer reports. And so I'm very, very, very pleased that that's something which has translated. So we need to take that into the clinic properly now, proper clinical trials, and our research has shown we need to put it into all those studies with radiotherapy, and then we need to put it into those chemotherapy agents, particularly those where you give it, say, once every 2 weeks, once every 3 weeks, so we can give the cannabis preparations intermittently and hopefully enhance the effects of chemotherapy, because that's what we've seen in the laboratory.
That's really interesting. So what you're saying there is that your discovery led you to think that it's not that the cannabis has some effect on the cells per se, which debilitates them, but it's the withdrawal of the cannabis, a bit like the kind of effects that people have from withdrawal of a drug, that actually debilitates them.
Absolutely. Now, we do know the difference between a tumour cell and a normal cell. There's sort of three major ones. One, the tumour cell gobbles up much more glucose, sugar, yes, and that's the basis of the PET scan. You know, when you have a PET scan, the bright lights are due to, that's sugar, that's radio-labeled sugar. Right. And that says you've got cells there gobbling up more glucose than the normal cells, and that's how they detect if the cancer spread. The second thing is they love acidic environments, and if it's not acidic, they will make it acidic. So right, the tumour will make its environment acidic, and also it loves environments with low oxygen, anoxia. So, and in fact, if it's in an area with good oxygen, like the lung, it will wall itself off and create its own environment. So the tumours are very good at evolving and creating their own environment. Mm-hmm. After seeing these experiments and repeating them many times, I said to these three cardinal features of tumour, I will add a fourth, is they rapidly become addicted to cannabinoids. So when they're withdrawn, they go into cold turkey.
All right.
And that's the only analogy I could come up with. And I've been thinking many, many times, reading many, many pathways that it may interfere with to try and explain this. But that's the only thing I can come up with. But cannabinoids, like opiates, are absolutely vital to all mammalian cells, cells and biological systems. So they're absolutely vital. You don't have mammalian systems without the cannabinoid network of receptors, etc.
So very fundamental to our health and well-being.
Indeed.
Look, that's really very interesting indeed. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sure a lot of people listening will want to hear that. Okay, so we're coming towards the end of our time. So you've been responsible for some considerable advances in our understanding of cancer, and particularly of the immune system. I just wanted to ask, which of these are you the most proud of?
Well, the one I'm most proud of, and I think has made the biggest impact, and that's been recognised with I had a prize and the impactful case report for the universities in the last breath, was basically identifying that thalidomide was a very useful drug and had been thrown out with the bathwater.
Yes.
And because I was an oncologist, I was not bothered about its dreadful side effects and birth defects, etc., because I was aware that all the drugs we use can cause birth defects if we give it at the wrong time. So you just got to be very, very careful. And so I didn't see that as a problem in developing it. But going for getting the company, it was run by two British people that I knew very well at the time, Dave Serling and Stephen Thomas, who basically first contacted me when I said, you know, this is a great drug to go for. And that has led, you know, speed forward, that led to Revlimid lenalidomide, who we first identified the efficacy in this laboratory at George's, which I put into the first person in the world, and then the phase one study. And, you know, I remember phoning the chairman of the company up, and I said, only a lunatic would make a big speculation and pronouncement and prophecy on just a few patients. But I'm that lunatic, and I said, this drug's going to be a blockbuster. and it's turned out to be the case. I mean, 2 years ago, it was the second biggest selling drug in the world.
Really?
So from an impact point, so the impact point of view, that is clearly the greatest. The second thing, I think, is taking the vaccine point of view and looking at how you immunise against the tumour, and realising very early on that if you use antigen-specific vaccines, the tumour is going to become very resistant very quickly, and that the best of all the vaccines we've worked with was a non-specific immune modulator stimulator, which is a heat-killed organism. It basically is really quite amazing, and those are the ones, developments of that is what I published recently, and had a really good survival benefit in advanced pancreatic cancer when combined with chemotherapy. But it is that, as I said, we really need to learn from other things, such as the vitamin D. So patients on that trial had vitamin D. Now, was that a major reason too? So it leads us to, is it the combination? Is it the combination of all these things we need to do? And I would like in future to do repeat that study again with the anti-inflammatories. And just to show how I think, is that this pancreatic cohort of metastatic disease, they're one of the patients who do not respond to these new immunotherapy antibodies. In fact, it's out there. This treatment doesn't respond at all. But patients who have this non-specific immune stimulation and other drugs which you could say were anti-inflammatories, there are one or two cases where they've been given this out of desperation and they responded brilliantly. So we have opened up the concept that you need to look very carefully at how you use treatment sequentially. And as I speak, I'm working on a manuscript where we have shown that two drugs, widely known, two drugs used together don't add anything to one drug alone apart from increased toxicity dreadfully. However, if you use that drug alone and it doesn't work and you use the second drug, then it's really quite effective. It would induce a very good clinical outcome. So that is quite incredible. That's my next manuscript to go off again. That's looking back at all the patients over the years.
Wow.
And I think we're going to be more and more looking at the sequentiality of how we use these treatments. Do we try with chemo followed by immunotherapy, etc., etc.? That's the way we're going to go. And that, I guess, is what I'm most proud of. And that includes the things like the checking the vitamin D and the anti-inflammatories. I think it's going to make a major impact.
Mm-hmm. So an extraordinary number of questions you're trying to answer at once. In fact, you're juggling all these different things you're pursuing. It must be quite a difficulty to pick out the most important questions and stick to those.
Yes, it is. This is called focus. I mean, when you have scientific projects, you're always taught to focus. But if you're doing something which is looking increasingly like it's unlikely to work, you need to have something going along in parallel. And I guess that's, I've always been a very keen fan of that, even when being told by grant bodies and review bodies, etc., focus, focus, focus. Well, my argument is no point focusing on something that's looking less and less likely to work the more you focus on that.
Yes. Well, very sane. Great. Well, look, we're going to have to end it now. Professor Dalgliesh, so thanks really very much for coming on the show today and sharing the details of your incredible work. It's been so interesting. We must try not to leave it so long next time.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
As I hinted at the outset, there was a wealth of vital information in that interview. Once again, the power of integrative medicine, the combining of natural medicine and orthodox approaches, produces significant results. In the case of cannabis, with radiotherapy, with chemotherapy, or with immunotherapy. Basic insights into the relationship between inflammation and cancer could translate into the success or failure of almost any treatment. And simple awareness of vitamin D levels could prove similarly crucial. You can find links to material mentioned in today's show by going to the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk, and click the show logo that's on the homepage. While you're there, you may want to have a quick peek at the summary on the events page of what's in store for 2019. Many thanks for listening today. I hope you can join me again next week. Goodbye.